hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're coming down my countrymen, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my countryman, you're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a fought and died to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on White Resistance Radio. .com. Lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Lots more news and views for our people. And here's my local paper in the city of Hamilton, which is a city of about 520,000 people, 40 miles west of Toronto. And this is an article from about a week ago. Liberal, that's a provincial, I'm sorry. This is from Victoria, British Columbia. Parties regroup to lasso new votes. The British Columbia Liberals will unveil a new province-wide recruitment drive for candidates this week as the opposition party struggles to shake off baggage from its years in government and prepares to push some of the oldest MLAs into retirement. Those are the elected members of the provincial legislature. Speaking about the manipulation, see, the Liberals narrowly lost the last provincial election. Well, in fact, they won. They had one more seat than the Socialist NDP, but the New Democratic Party made a deal with the three Green Party members of the provincial legislature, and they formed a government together. Okay. The tone fascinates me. The party has a new online portal where anyone interested in running in any riding in the next election can express interest directly to party headquarters. The goal, said leader Andrew Wilkinson, is to attract candidates from underrepresented communities in the legislature. such as women, millennials, First Nations, those are Indians, various ethnic groups, and people with disabilities. Oh my gosh, I guess the ideal candidate would be a retarded Native Indian lesbian. Now, they'd be able to tick off a number of categories there. Quote, we're opening up the idea of recruiting candidates to as wide an audience as we can. Quote, the goal is to attract the best possible candidates to run for the Liberal Party in the next election. Well, I would agree with that. Could attract the best. So far, they've got 87 people who expressed interest. We want to be a party that reflects the full diversity of this province, that have a very strong gender mix, and is proud to carry the banner of the party in the next election. Anyway, they worry that they're going to have to encourage some of their older members of the elected members to retire and to make room for some of the more diversity. This is, political correctness at its usual insane level. Why should it not be their purpose to attract the best? Never mind diversity. Here's an interesting write up in the National Post that contains some, I think, very important information or thoughts about school. I know the radicalization of the education system is certainly an issue that worries a good many parents. A few years ago, when the Liberals governed Ontario, there was a great deal of disgruntlement and protest from religious and conservative parents who opposed the way that Liberals ran the public school system. Now that Doug Ford, who's a populist, is in charge, the progressives are aghast at the changes the conservatives are bringing in, including revisions to the sex ed curriculum, funding cuts for energy efficient renovations, and the possible removal of the cap on class sizes. And it's particularly the sex education program, which is being dialed back a little bit. Liberal premier, the lesbian Kathleen Wynne, brought in a sex ed curriculum that is horrific. This is when she was Minister of Education, and it began when she was minister, and then she became premier. And the person who helped write most of the curriculum turns out now to be a Jewish convicted pedophile, convicted of numerous counts of possession of child pornography. That's exactly the type of person you want writing the sex ed curriculum. Well, not surprisingly, the sex ed curriculum was appalling, pushing discussions of LGBTQ into the little grades. Basically, it was pushing the LGBTQ agenda, introducing concepts of anal sex practically down into kindergarten. Okay. And Doug Ford's conservatives are pulling back on that. Conservatives are unhappy with their children's school in the Liberal system, and those on the left are unhappy with Ford's education decisions on education. A reasonable person might well conclude that the real power problem in Ontario is a government school monopoly, which forces diverse families into the same educational system, except for those who can afford to pay twice for schooling, first by paying school taxes and then paying for private tuition. No one is forcing all Ontario residents to get their food from a single government-run taxpayer-funded grocery store chain, or their clothes from a government retailer. It is a wonder that a government monopoly, which is correctly regarded as absurd for just about everything else, should be considered normal in terms of schools. When it comes to education, just as in food and clothing, parents have different interests and values to meet their children's needs. He goes on to say that many parents are dissatisfied with the government-run schools. all or part of the money the government would spend on that child's education should be refunded to the parents in the form of a voucher, which could be used to purchase private schooling subject to no government regulations except for minimal academic credit requirements. And this is the voucher system. The idea is not a new one, but I think it's a very good one. The government should calculate roughly what it would cost to educate a child at a particular level. Let's say, what would it cost to educate little Joey at, grade 6? Okay, then something called a grade 6 voucher would be given to the parents. Now, the parents can go and present that voucher at any educational institution and buy the education that they feel would best reflect their children's needs. This would have several advantages. First, it would be fair. It's giving parents a choice. And under this proposal, it's possible that a parent could use the voucher at let's say a government school, but also that the parent could choose to take that voucher to a private school and get the and buy the education for his grade 6 child in that way. This would provide parents with choice. Well, I'll tell you who is fanatically opposed to that, and that is the most of the education system, the teachers' unions, and most of the professionals. I'll tell you why. Because, among other for one thing, it's a comfortable little monopoly. If parents had more choice, some of the laziness that characterizes some of the teaching profession would have an entitlement. Might have to go by the roadside. Parents would be able to control a good deal more carefully what their children get. And there's I've been in the education system, so I know this to be true. There is an arrogance on the part of some educators. We know what's best. Parents are these reactionary, ultra-conservative, morally backward people. We know what's best for their children, and this arrogance permeates the thinking of the system. There are people who see education basically as a propaganda exercise. We're going to usher in change in the new generation. In other words, we're going to propagandize them, and they are mortally afraid of the voucher system. Anyway, the article continues. The teachers' unions would naturally protest. They would call spending public money for private schooling an outrage. But the money was collected from taxpayers for educating children. If parents decide that the money would be more effective in educating their children in a privately run school, they'll be reflecting their values. It might be conservative Christian values. It might be particular academic values. But the parents' money would be targeted to what the parent wanted. Objections to giving parents more choice aren't about ensuring quality schools for the benefit of students. They're about ensuring the government and union monopolies. Indeed, Western provinces, let's see, Western Canada, offer more school choices than Ontario does, and the benefits are clear. In British Columbia, independent schools are able to access some of the money collected by the government for education, with subsidies of up to 50% of the per student cost in public schools, giving families more access to independent schools and to higher quality education. In Alberta, parental choice even gets more support. Independent schools can access public education funds up to 70%. Well, it should be 100% of the cost of educating the child. Of course, in the howls of outrage that accompany this proposal, or the opposition to this proposal, one of the arguments, of course, is that it can be used for discriminatory education. Well, why not? Why not? In certain areas, many European parents do not want their children going to a public school where there's a significant number of disruptive blacks who have to be catered to, who the system has to bend over backwards to try to educate and accommodate. And the system in Toronto has staggered on for well over 30 years. Well, from one silly program to another. In fact, a few years ago, it was finally decided that a good idea would be all black schools, because the present education system didn't meet the needs of blacks, who need apparently studies in black history, which give them an utterly false notion of black history, of their own importance, and so on. Many parents do not want their children being educated in such an environment, and would opt for a private school where the population more accurately reflects them and their values. And what's the matter with that? Oh, that's discrimination. Well, no, it's not discrimination against anybody. Reflecting a system that reflects the values of the parents, rather than having the children forced into a school system where the population may not reflect the values of the parents. Is that discrimination? You bet it is. And there's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with it. Now, I'm sure most of you have heard of actor Liam Neeson, an Irishman who has played in a wide variety of movies over the years, in no particular order. Movies like Collins, about the Irish Republican Army, outstanding strategist Michael Collins, and many others. Anyway, he recently shared some thoughts from his past, and that's caused a great uproar of condemnation. Here's from a very lengthy article in the National Post. In an interview published by The Independent, that's a paper in England, earlier this week, Liam Neeson shared an anecdote about seeking revenge. 40 years ago, upon discovering someone close to him, as a female, had been raped, he learned the race of the attacker, and in response, wandered the streets looking to murder a black person. It took him a week to come to his senses. Quote, "I understand that need for revenge, but it just leads to more revenge, to more killing, and more killing." While it seems likely that Neeson intended to explain how senseless the pursuit of vengeance can be, the emphasis for most was placed on the jarring revelation of racism, the otherwise indiscriminate targeting of, as the actor put it, any black bastard. In response, some pundits have suggested that his comments amount to a career suicide, that Hollywood is unlikely to offer him a second act. However, others have questioned why so much outrage is being foisted upon someone for admitting he had a terrible thought 4 decades ago. But no matter if we accept the content of his story or isolate its disturbingly prejudiced aspect, it's difficult to imagine that Neeson's box office appeal will be diminished. CinemaScore reports suggests his films perform well with an older-than-average demographic. At 66, Neeson remains a sex symbol an icon for masculinity who has grown older alongside his audience, mostly on the back of the type of revenge fantasies, minus the overt racism, that he described happening four decades ago. If anything, the story only further cements the ominous association between our celebration of revenge fiction and its unsavory underpinnings. He's starred in movies like Schindler's List, The Good Mother in 1988. Anyway, a few more details before I make a comment on it. So a lot of his movies are revenge movies. Movies like Taken 3, there are a number of Taken movies where which involve trying to avenge a crime. Anyway, when we have to parse the details, Neeson said a close friend of his reported that she had been attacked and raped by a black man. Neeson said that for a week he cruised the streets hoping that some black bastard would attack him. Now, there's a big difference between saying, I went out looking for revenge, wanting to beat up the first black person I saw. That, of course, would be unjust. What he said he did was that he cruised around hoping that some black criminal would attack him, so that he could, he was at one point an amateur boxer, so that he could put a beating on the guy. Now this is denounced as racism. First of all, any attack would in fact be a crime. An attack on him would be a crime. Now, the fact that he might be ready for it and prepared to fight back is something else. One might suggest that it might be a bit unwise, especially if he wasn't armed, because not all attackers would necessarily come at him with fists. And what was he trying to do? Well, he was trying to find the type of person, not necessarily the perpetrators of the rape of his friend, who commit wanton acts of violence, very often against white people. Now, how is that racism? If he said, I would go out and try to beat up the first black male I found, that indeed might be racism, or racial targeting. But if he said, and as he does, that the fantasize about running into a situation or finding a situation where he would be attacked by some black, how is that racism? The attack would have to occur. If a black person passed him by and didn't attack him, Leeson is not suggesting he would attack that person. Only if he himself were attacked. The article, of course, neatly glosses over the fact that much of the violent crime in the United States is committed by a tiny minority, blacks. In fact, there's a book brought out by Jared Taylor of the American Renaissance. The book is about more than a decade old, but it's called The Color of Crime. And it's an analysis based on FBI crime statistics. The color of crime, violent crime, in the United States is overwhelmingly black. The victims are overwhelmingly black. But interracial crime is overwhelmingly blacks attacking whites. That's a fact. And it's not racism, whatever that is, to say so. In fact, it's race realism. If you're looking for a violent person who is going to attack a stranger, and with a view to raping them, overwhelmingly in the United States, you're going to be looking for a black person. That's not to say there aren't white rapists, but but the trend is not in that direction. Here's a very disturbing story out of today's National Post. Foreign meddling in pipeline debate. Now, Canada has a real problem. We need more oil pipelines. We are producing a great deal of heavy oil in our tar sands up in northern Alberta. And there's a problem getting it to market. There are a number of solutions, and I don't want to digress into some of the other solutions for the oil industry, but one solution that has been proposed is pipelines, or more pipelines. One was supposed to go build on an existing Trans-Canada pipeline that goes from the oil fields to eastern Canada, and it would be extended and punched down into New Brunswick to the port of St. John, where there would be a huge oil refinery. That would be a good idea. Well, that got canceled. Then there was been two different proposals to route pipelines from Alberta through British Columbia, one up to the port of Prince Rupert in the north, and one to down to Vancouver. Both of those have come under tremendous fire from radical environmentalists, Indian bands, and the sort of climate change fanatics who want us to completely get off fossil fuels, which in the near foreseeable future is impossible. Not going to happen. That opposition based on fanaticism is disturbing enough, but get this. Cenovus Energy of Calgary has tripled its contracted space on the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, but remains concerned by reports that suspected foreign influences are using social media to constrain new pipeline projects in the country. The one project that, after tremendous battling both in Canada and the United States, seems to have gone through is the Keystone pipeline, which would go from southern Alberta down to the Gulf of Mexico. Now, this was opposed in various areas by environmental radicals, and President Obama, or then President Obama, dithered and dithered and dithered, and in the end refused to authorize the building of this pipeline. President Trump has, but there are still legal attempts to prevent its building. Cenovus president and CEO Alex Pourbaix said he was disappointed but not surprised by a Canadian Broadcasting Corporation report this week that showed thousands of social media accounts originating in oil-producing countries such as Russia, Iran, and Venezuela have posted millions of messages directed at Canadians on various topics, including the construction of new pipelines. Quote, if anybody thinks the world is a better place with Canadian oil being replaced with oil from those countries, they're not thinking very clearly. Global demand for oil and gas continues to rise every year. We can either be part of the solution, or we can be the world's Boy Scouts. Yeah, some of the, not all by any means, but some of the opposition dressed up as environmentalism is in fact funded by shady major oil producers like Venezuela and Iran. To put it slightly differently, if Canadians can be fooled into not making use of their own oil or not getting it to market, somebody else will be happy to supply our oil needs, like foreign countries, like Venezuela and Iran and others. This is painfully obvious. And yet, people assume that the environmental opposition to pipelines and so on is honest. And I'm not saying that some of it is not, but there is certainly a dirty tricks element. You know, if we can somehow be gulled into not producing more oil, or not actually getting our oil to market, well, that means there's more market share, particularly for countries like Venezuela. Rats, public defecation, and open drug use. Our major Western cities are becoming uninhabitable hell holes. And this is by Michael Snyder. Almost everyone who goes out to visit one of our major cities on the West Coast has a similar reaction. Those who must live among the escalating decay are often numb to it. But most of those who are just in town for a visit are absolutely shocked by all of the trash, human defecation, crime, and public drug use they encounter. Once upon a time, our beautiful Western cities, that's in Western U.S., were the envy of the rest of the world. But now they serve as a shining example of America's accelerating decline. The worst part of our major Western cities literally look like post-apocalyptic wastelands, and the hordes of zombified homeless people that live in those areas are too drugged out to care. The ironic thing is that most of these cities are not poor. In fact, San Francisco and Seattle are among the wealthiest cities in the entire nation. So if things are falling apart this dramatically now, how bad will things get when the economic conditions really begin to deteriorate? Let's start our discussion by looking at the rat epidemic in Los Angeles. Thanks to extremely poor public sanitation, rats are breeding like mad. And at this point, they have even conquered Los Angeles City Hall. Officials at Los Angeles City Hall are considering ripping all of the building carpets up as rats and fleas are said to be running riot in its halls. A motion was filed by Council President Herb Wesson on Wednesday recently to enact the much-needed makeover amid a typhus outbreak in the downtown area. Typhus! And of course, typhus is a disease associated with filth and rats. Wesson said a city employee had contracted the deadly bacterial disease at work and now is urging officials to investigate the scope of the long-running pest problem in the council building. You know, that's not in a tenement in the slums. That's in city council, city hall. People from all over the world are drawn to Los Angeles because of what they have seen on television, but is truly a filthy, filthy place. The number of homeless has risen, has been rising about 20% a year. Public drug use is seemingly everywhere, and there are mountains of trash all over the place. Needless to say, rats thrive in such an environment, and the epic battle that one LA journalist is having with rats was recently featured in the LA Times. East side, west side, north and south, they're everywhere. If you're a rat, the California housing crisis has not hit you yet and never will. At our house, it sounded like the rats were having relay races in the ceiling, and they don't wear sneakers. Your eyes blink and your leg twitches as you drift off to sleep, knowing that if the plague comes back, you're living in ground zero. This is actually from the LA Times. In our garden, they devoured entire heads of lettuce. They destroyed my squash just before it was ripe and ready to eat. They stole my tomatoes, cilantro, and Anaheim chili peppers. were they bottling their own salsa. but let's not be too hard on Los Angeles, because the same things are going on that are going on there are happening in major cities all over the western portion of the United States. For example, a massive rat infestation recently forced authorities to close a shockingly filthy homeless encampment under a bridge in Salem, Oregon. This is a local report. Amid the trash, human despair, and anguish, one weeping woman prepared to leave the most recent place she knows as home without any real inkling of where she'll go next. Terry Ballow, an outreach worker with the Salvation Army, has been here for the darker moments of living life under a bridge. Anger, mental illness, drug use, and human frustration boiling over at times everywhere one looks. Yet it was a rat infestation and concern about human health that prompted the city of Salem to move the campers out. It just grew and grew and got worse, Ballow said. It's badder than people can imagine. I think she really ought to be saying worse, but okay. Yes, there've always been homeless encampments in this country, but in modern times we've never faced anything on the scale that we're facing now. More than 500,000 Americans are homeless right now. And that's like about 1 in every 650. And that number continues to grow. And as it grows, communities will increasingly be forced to make some tough decisions. I'm quite eager to talk about San Francisco. But before we get to the city on the bay, let's take note of something that just happened in Denver. If you are into public defecation, you'll be very happy to learn that Denver just made it legal. First, the obvious. The city, Denver City Council has voted unanimously to decriminalize a number of offenses, including defecating in public, also urinating in public, camping on public or private land without permission, panhandling, and lying across public rights of ways, such as sidewalks. No, those are any longer illegal, at least in Denver. Democrat Mayor Michael Hancock and city officials explain the new ordinances are designed to protect immigrants, legal and otherwise, from unintended consequences. These consequences were fines and longer jail terms, as had been customarily in most places for violating the behavioral norms of a civilized American society. So to cater to immigrants, particularly illegals, basic standards go out the window. If only America's founders could see us now, they would be so proud. Speaking of public defecation, San Francisco has become world famous for the piles of human poop that constantly litter the streets. During one seven-day stretch last summer, a total of 16,000 official complaints were submitted to the city about human feces. One seven-day stretch! Wow. Plus, with such beautiful natural surroundings and so much wealth, San Francisco should be a great place to visit. But that definitely is not the case. When reporter John Stossel recently visited San Francisco, he was stunned by what he found. Quote, San Francisco is a pretty good place to hang out with a sign. People are rarely arrested for vagrancy, aggressive panhandling, or going to the bathroom in front of people's homes. In 2015, there were 60,491 complaints to police, but only 125 people were arrested. That's for public defecation. Public drug use is generally ignored. One woman told us, it's nasty seeing people shoot up right in front of you. People don't do anything about it. They'll get somebody for drinking a beer, but walk right past people using needles. Right. Clamping down on the innocent pleasures of, well, more or less normal people. In San Francisco, they actually give out free syringes to drug addicts. And it's being reported that they handed out a total of 5.8 million free syringes in 2018. Insane for a population which I believe is about 500,000. Of course, not by no means all of those people in San Francisco are drug addicts. I mean, they're supporting a population of drugged out people. That's a lot of syringes. They're also trying to get the syringes back in order to prevent the spread of disease, but it hasn't been too successful. Using dirty needles is an excellent way to spread such wonderful illnesses as hepatitis. There's just one problem, well, more than one. Despite spending an extra $1.8 million last year in an effort to retrieve needles, according to the San Francisco Chronicle, the department handed out more than 2 million more syringes than it got back, many of which are now washing around the streets of one of the richest cities in America, along with the feces of their users. And with so much public drug use going on, it should be no surprise that crime is completely and totally out of control. And here's more from reporter John Stossel. Each day in San Francisco, an average of 85 cars are broken into. Inside Edition ran a test to see how long stereo equipment would last in a parked car. Their test car was quickly broken into. And the camera crew discovered that their own car had been broken into as well. It's been said that as goes California, so goes the country.
and this is where the rest of the nation is headed, then we're in serious trouble. When Bill Blaine recently visited San Francisco, he was so horrified by what he encountered that he felt he must write about it. He wrote, "I hope my American hosts will forgive me for raising this, but the squalor we saw in the city was frightful. San Francisco has always been one of my favorite U.S. cities, but the degree of homelessness, mental illness, and drug abuse we saw on this trip was truly shocking. Walking around San Francisco on a Sunday morning, we saw sights we couldn't believe. This must be one of the richest cities in the world, home to 4 of the 10 richest people on the planet, according to Wikipedia. I asked friends about it, and they shrugged it off. The city's always attracted the homeless because of the mild weather. It's a drug thing. It's too difficult. You get used to it." "Well, I didn't," he says. "I found it quite shocking, and the number of folks sleeping rough on the sidewalks, the smell of weed and drug impedimenta everywhere, the filth, mental illness, and degradation on view just a few meters from the financial center driving Silicon Valley. It's a city where the destitute seem to have become invisible to the Uber-hailing elites. We found ourselves hopping on one of the beautiful F-Route trolley buses to find nearly every seat occupied by someone lugging their worldly possessions around in a plastic bag. It was desperately sad. San Francisco has a new mayor, and they are going to spend millions upon millions of dollars to try to clean up the streets. But it won't be easy to turn things around because more drug users and homeless people are moving to the city every day." And this, as the several reporters I've quoted, is an absolutely public scandal and a blight on America. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on White Resistance Radio.
Just walk on by, wait on the corner. I love you, but these strangers when we meet. Just walk on by, wait on the corner.
it's Helen Miles, and this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me on my musical interlude. Go play another song by Heather. This is an old Ray Price tune. Miles and Crazy Arms, old Ray Price tune. Heather Miles, Justin Trevino, this time I know we're gonna make it.
This time I know we're gonna make it.
Heather Miles and Justin Trevino. And this is another blonde country western singer, Lacey J. Dalton. Turn to the One.
Small voices deep inside you. Turn.
Dalton, turn to the one. And this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. We're back with you again tomorrow night, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe, the dauntless hero, came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours, which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save